As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Standing Room Only podcast. Yes, I'm your host, Ben Standing, and I cover the Washington Commanders for The Athletic, which of course means I was at FedEx Field Sunday night watching the Washington Commanders fall 20-12 to the New York Giants in a, needless to say, this was a huge game for both of these teams, and which whoever lost was going to see their playoff chances take a dip, but they're not out of it by any stretch of the imagination. I discussed what happened last night as well as some other conversations about this team right now, including where are things going with this offense, with Sam Fortier from the Washington Post. I'll get to that in a second. And because I'm getting, I didn't get a podcast up last night. Look, I get you. Writing is the main thing I've got to do. And by the time I got everything done, it was a late night. So, but we're doing it now. But as a little bit of a bonus, I thought I would do a little mini mailbag after my interview with Sam. So that's what we've got going on here, breaking down everything that's kind of going on with the Commanders right now with Sam, as well as some answering some of your questions. Now, I will just say here, though, quickly at the top. Oh, by the way, sometimes I forget to promote these things. You can, of course, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere you do your podcasting. You know, hit the subscribe button. That way you know the podcasts are there for you whenever they publish. Also, make sure to go subscribe or check me out on The Athletic. New story up yesterday, following the game, David Aldridge as well. All right, a couple quick things, though. We just talked to Ron Rivera a few minutes ago. I'm talking to you on Monday afternoon. And I wouldn't say it was any, like, major revelations, but I do want to get into a couple of quick things. And I'll play you some audio from Ron Rivera today to sort of discuss this. First off, let's get to the quarterback stuff. Ron Rivera was asked by my colleague David Aldridge, just flat out, are you thinking about making a change? Here is that exchange from earlier today.
Ron, do you give any thought to a change of quarterback for next week?
No, David. I think the biggest thing more than anything else is, you know, sticking with Taylor and what we're trying to establish. You know, and it is something, though, that obviously is talked about, obviously, out there. And it is something that, you know, to be quite frank, as I do have to think about at some point. But if we can continue to – if we can get back on track and play the way we've played and do the things that we've done, you know, then we'll stick with where we are. Until then, you know, I will do that.
All right. Now, I want to also then play for you – I mean, look, he says there that he's staying with Heinicke, but that he's got to, you know, he's got to keep in his mind that maybe you make the change. I mean, I think that's all reasonable. And me personally, I would have been surprised if he said Heinicke wasn't the starter. But I do wonder about, you know, if you're trailing again at halftime, you know, does he have a quick hook? I think the answer there was yes. But I wanted to then also get to questions that I asked Rivera. I asked these before he was asked about whether he's considering a change, but they are Heinicke related. And you'll hear them. One has to do with what is the identity of this offense and what happened to the idea that if Heinicke's strength is his mobility to help avoid the pass rush, What do we think now because the Giants were able to get to him a bunch during these two games? So here's my exchange with Ron Rivera today.
Ron, to sort of follow up on a little bit of that, at this point into the season, I'm curious, what do you see as your offensive identity? Because you do have the power running with Robinson, you have the receivers. What is the identity of this offense right now?
Okay, so to repeat it again, I think we can run the football, and we can run the football downhill. And off of that, we can be a play-action team, a bootleg team, a physical upfront team. It gives our offensive line an opportunity to fire out and not have to catch as much. We've seen that that has been successful, and we've got to continue on with that type of mentality, in my opinion, just because I believe that is part of the formula. It's part of what we can do, and it's been successful for us.
And part of the appeal with Taylor is his mobility, of course, and with to avoid pass rushers, extend plays, et cetera. The Giants were able to get to him, though, a fair amount. Has that something changed with that regard, or is it? How do you kind of view that aspect of it? If Taylor's strength is this ability to mobility and extend plays, when the other front is kind of getting at him a bit more?
Well, there was a couple opportunities that came up where he was in the pocket. It was third and long situations. I really think only one of them was a first down or second down situation, second and long situation. So when we were put ourselves into passing situations, really is when we had trouble and we struggled. When we're in situations where we're staying ahead of the chains, as I said, it makes our play action viable. And that's something we have to be aware of and be even better at.
All right. Now I talk about this, the identity aspect with Sam, so I don't want to step on things too much, but ultimately it just does seem to me that if you're going to have acquired Carson Wentz because of his big arm, there's nothing that says you have to then throw the ball 40 times a game. You could run the same general ideas that you did with Heinicke, meaning lean into the power running, as Rivera said, make that your focal point. But now for play action, which again Rivera talked about, you have a quarterback with a huge arm that can make accurate throws down the field, as we saw earlier this year. And that combination with Robinson seems like it could be pretty strong. And if the Heinicke mobility aspect is not, I'm not saying it's not working, but if it's not giving you some definitive edge and then there's some of these other concerns, it doesn't seem to me to be that tough of a decision. But obviously it isn't just about that. There's other variables, chemistry perhaps with the locker room or whatever it may be. Again, whenever I mention that, I'm not saying bad things about Wentz. I'm just saying the Heinicke hive and people seem to like Heinicke. At the same point, players were talking last night about the red zone issues. John Allen, in one of my main quotes in my story today, when I asked him what went wrong in the game, he said turnovers, penalties, and red zone scoring. That was the game, end quote. I asked a different question a moment later about the sort of the defense, and he came back to that exact same thing. And I'm just going to, if the defense is talking about the red zone scoring, I mean, they are aware of what's going on here. They're never going to call each other out. And that's, of course, you don't want that to happen, but everybody recognizes the red zone scoring is a problem. So what do you do about it? And the quarterback situation is the most obvious thing you could do, but we will see how that goes. All right, here's what I'm going to do now. We're going to get into my conversation with Sam Fortier with the Post. You can, of course, follow Sam on Twitter at Sam4TR. And, of course, while I'm here, you can follow me at Ben Standing as well. So here's my conversation from before Ron Rivera talked today with Sam Fortier about what went on in that loss Sunday night and where things are going forward with the Commanders.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic.
All right. As promised, joining me on the podcast is one of our talented writers on the beat. But before, you know, here's the deal. I could pick a few different people to come on with the beat. But like for this particular one, when you have a night game, you need the grinders. You need the ones who are there till all hours of the night. And I'm leaving the press box at some ungodly hour. And there was only one other reporter in there with me. And he is here with me now on this podcast. He is Sam Fortier with The Washington Post. Late nights, like last people in the press box. That's what you and I are all about, Sam. Am I right about this? I mean, you know, game in, game out, we're consistently the ones pretty much there.
Absolutely. I think you and I benefit from you working at The Athletic and me writing what the Post calls our, like, post-game follow. We are not on any tight print deadlines. We don't have, you know, the video obligations. So that helps us. You know, stew in what I'm sure you, like me, would consider like your brain of trying to understand exactly how this all went down and trying to contextualize that. And it just takes time, man. And especially after those night games, that leads to a late night.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to deviate here for one quick second. So there was one game where was the game where we got stuck? Like, was that in Indianapolis?
In Indianapolis. Yeah. You and I got stuck. I think we were both there after like the security exit had closed. So for all the listeners, there was an incredible moment where Standing and I were hopping over a fence trying to get out of Lucas Oil.
Right. Like, I mean, you know, you obviously, if you're going as a game as a fan, you know, the game ends, you leave at within, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, whatever, and the gates are open. But when you're in the press box and you're in the media and you're there for several hours, they forget you exist sometimes, and they close up shop, and you can't physically find a way to get out. Now, there probably was a way, but we're not at our home stadium, so we don't know. So Sam finds this one spot where, like, it's not an exit. You could it was just like hopping over, like a little barrier kind of thing, and then you had to hop over like a, there was like some, what do you call that? So some
It was like a 6-foot drop into a garden bed.
Yeah, basically. So, look, Sam's young and spry, and he did it easy. I'm not, like, decrepit, but, like, I'm not, you know, there's only so much I'm doing these days in terms of, like, working out and exercising. So I then tried to do it, and, needless to say, we made it out. But, like, I was, like, slightly unsure of my footing. Like, I felt like I was, like, I don't know. Maybe I didn't have confidence in my knees to drop down, or I don't know. So anyway, so I do it, but like I'm holding on to this ledge to drop down. I'm not kidding. This is embarrassing to admit. Like, my forearm hurt for like a month. I don't know what I did.
I must have pulled something. It was ridiculous. So that was probably like, if somebody said to me, what was the point you felt really old this season? That might have been the one, other than perhaps right now, because the lack of sleep is definitely a real thing. No complaints. This is fun. I'm just saying, this is where we're at right now.
One more thing I would add to that Indianapolis story is that game was Central Time, or it was like a 4:25 Eastern kick. I think we left the press box maybe at 11 midnight-ish, and there were people who like had clearly gone to the game and were going home from the bar, and they walked past us as we were doing this, and I could see them like laughing and being like, what are those people doing? Are they trying to break into Lucas Oil? So I have very fond memories of that experience.
Yeah, that was a if it's a highlight or a low light, but it was a light of some sort on the season for me and for you. All right, well, let's shed some light on what happened here. We've had a little bit of time to reflect, and like I imagine, if you're listening to this podcast, you've already been reading a lot about it, you've been looking at things online, and you've already formed some thoughts. We'll do our best to try to add some new insight and move forward a little bit. I guess just biggest takeaway, yes, they obviously blew a huge opportunity. I guess for you, what's your big takeaway though in terms of what happened and why did Washington ultimately find itself on the wrong end of that 20-12 game last night?
There are certainly a bunch of factors, officiating, Taylor Heineke's sack fumble. There's a lot of different factors, but to me, the biggest problem, and I wrote about this today, was the emergence of the red zone struggles again. And I say that because they kept stalling out. This offense, the red zone is really important for it because they're run first, they're inexplosive. Taylor Heineke is, I think he has pretty much had the same game every day, every week that he's been a starter. He yo-yos between like inexplicable brilliance and massive mistakes. And like, that's just who that guy is. But you have to turn those red zone trips into touchdowns. You can't stall out and kick field goals because your margin of error is so thin when you're not scoring that many points. So to me, the reemergence of the red zone struggles and how much every offensive player in the locker room focused on it last night was really telling to me, because, them stalling out in the first quarter and then, again in the second quarter, they have the touchdown in the third, but those two fourth quarter drives when you're deep in the red zone and you don't get it done, that, I think, it creates a situation where officials can play an outsized influence in the game. And I think that was, one of their biggest problems.
Yeah, for sure. And I do think I agree with you in terms of the end, the officials. I mean, look, I think we can all agree reasonably that Curtis Samuel was mugged, right? I mean, I think that seems like a reasonable take. And I'd be lying if I still had said I understood what the hell happened with the Terry McLaurin thing, when it seems clearly he's looking at the ref, says he's pointing to say, hey, am I good? And some sort of miscommunication there where the ref ultimately said not true. But, and this is what Ron Rivera's point was as well, if they produce in the red zone, those last few plays don't matter, right? And maybe that's a little simplistic because there's always something that's going to matter, but that is the point. This margin of error that they have is so tiny that they cannot afford any kind of mistakes. And I'm thinking back about this, during this surge where things were going well, right? They're the team that held the Bears outside, they're at the half yard line on the last play of the game. What's the Taylor Heineke shirt? F it, F it, Terry's down there somewhere.
Right.
That was born in the Indianapolis game where Heineke throws up basically a jump ball. McLaurin comes down to catch it. They set up the game winning touchdown. The Atlanta game a couple weeks ago, Daron Payne sticks up his hand, tips the ball, interception, with Atlanta about to score the game winning touchdown inside the five. They were the team making these plays, but that's also what it took for them to do it, because they just didn't have the ability to drop, 27, 30 points consistently or score easily almost ever. And this is the deal that they find themselves in. So we can complain about the refs and this, that, and the other, but ultimately you're right. I mean, the red zone aspect of it all for a team that's playing so tight with margin of error is tough. And also, this was a game where the defense, which has been bailing them out all year, no sacks, no turnovers, right? I mean, they could have done better, but like, it's hard to sit here and blame them when they've really, kind of set the tone for this turnaround. The offense has to pick them up and they couldn't do it.
They allowed 13 points at home off a bye week against an offense with two weapons. And yeah, of course, like the 97-yard drive where they convert a 4th and 9, that's inexcusable. That is unacceptable. But at the same time, they allowed 13 total points. That should be enough of a performance to get it done with the offense. And so to me, when and I think that there's a lot of questions I have here about like who is to blame for the offense big picture, right? Is it Scott Turner's play calling, or is he limited by his quarterback and his offensive line, which doesn't pass block well? And if that's true, then how much does the front office deserve blame for building an offensive line, you know, investing so many resources into building a passing offense, then giving that passing offense such bad pass blockers? So, I mean, I think that like you can have that debate and kind of assign blame in any way you choose, but this is the offense that that they are going to have. We're headed to week 16. It's too late to make substantial changes. Even if you put, you know, Carson Wentz in there, I think it just lowers the floor and raises the ceiling, but it's really ultimately probably the same. So to me, like, that's why the margins of the red zone are also super important, because this is just who you're going to be, and you've got to make those chances count.
Yeah, for sure. I was bleary-eyed, or I don't know if bleary-eyed matters if I'm talking, but whatever. I was a bleary-eyed this morning on the radio with Kevin Sheehan discussing all this stuff. And, you know, you're right. The micro level, yeah, all the things we just discussed, the penalties, the red zone and all that. But, like, on the bigger level, like, my question is, every team has multiple ways to score. You know, you hope, at least, you know, the good teams. But they also ultimately have an identity. Maybe it's the quarterback is, the ultimate decision maker, and the one making the plays, you know, if it's an Aaron Rodgers or a Tom Brady kind of a guy, or maybe it's a team like San Francisco where, like, the quarterback doesn't even matter that much because of the play calling and the run dynamics and things like that. I don't know if this team knows what its identity is. And the Brian Robinson aspect last night, I think, is an example, because clearly he was very effective. I mean, he is just, you know, running over people. It takes a village to take him down. But he only had 12 carries, only had 4 in the second half. Now, part of that is they were trailing. But, you know, if this is who you are, I think personally the Brian Robinson emergence is more responsible for why they've turned things around than Taylor Heinicke at this point. But you have these weapons at receiver, but McLaurin and Samuel and Dotson, who are also effective. You want to get the ball in their hands. And it feels like there's this constant push-pull between 1 minute they're the team that's going to run the ball over and over again with Brian Robinson, and then there's this team that has all these toys and they want to get the ball in their hands. And I don't think it doesn't feel like game in, game out, they know who they are on offense. And that leads to some of these problems. I mean, look, I'm not going to ignore the quarterback part, right? We can get to that aspect in terms of Heinicke Wentz in a minute, but I just don't know what they are. Plug and play, whoever's a quarterback, what is this team doing? And I think last night was a good example of they don't know it, and the play calling, I think, suffers at times.
Whenever you try to ask Scott Turner what he wants the offense's identity to be, he'll say, we want it to be multiple. We want to win in multiple ways. If they're shutting down our quick passing game, we want to be able to go vertical. We want to run the ball at times. You know, like, they want to be able to be different teams. I think that the thing about their offensive identity is we know that they can run the ball successfully. I think losing Tyler Larson at center really hurts that, because he's a bigger guy. He's a really good run blocker. They're running duo super well, during that stretch. But they are not a team that has shown they can win passing consistently, whether that be the offensive line, the quarterback, a mixture of the two. The thing that was egregious to me yesterday about the play calling, about, you know, kind of the rhythm and who are you using in what situations, is Brian Robinson rips off late in the fourth quarter, Brian Robinson rips off a 19-yard run to basically put them at the 11-yard line, you know, that lower red zone area. And the next play, I believe, was the Curtis Samuel jet sweep, which had already been very ineffective the previous two times he tried it. So to go back to that a third time and to get 1 yard off of it, I just thought to myself, like, it doesn't matter, I think, what your offensive identity is, as long as it's effective. And you had already had evidence that the Giants were playing that play particularly well. And I get that it worked the week before, but why make that play call in that situation it just felt a little tone deaf or forced to me.
Yeah, I agree. I did like a mailbag, I don't know, last week or something. And one of the questions was about Scott Turner, you know, is he good? Does he suck? Whatever. And like, I think my basic takeaway was like, I think, you know, look, I think Scott Turner is limited, obviously, with the quarterback situation. I think he's done some good things, but there are times where it feels like he wants to show you he's the smartest guy in the room, or look how creative I can be. You talk about these other play callers. Here's what I can do. And, you know, you can look at, like, I haven't looked at the all 22 or anything yet, but like the, you know, I'm sure there will be some plays where like, oh, look how open that guy was. It's not like he's not doing some things to get people open, but ultimately, you know, kind of like we're saying, like, what is the mindset in a given moment with the play calling? And then like, what's the identity? And I, you said something that reminded me of something. I almost hate to bring this up, being that you are a Syracuse guy. But I remember when I used to cover Georgetown basketball when in the John Thompson III Princeton offense era, and he would talk about what his teams were up to. You know, like, what was the plan? He's like, well, you know, if the defense gives us this, we'll take that, or vice versa. And when we talk about why did Georgetown struggle often in the NCAA tournaments, I always said it was because they're allowing the other team to dictate the terms. If you're just willing to take what the team is giving you, that's not enough. You have to decide at some point, we want to do these things. And that's where like the idea of being an offense that can beat you in multiple ways. Sure, of course. But what are you doing? Force the Giants to stop Brian Robinson, something they could not do, and something that has been really effective for this team for the last, you know, couple months. Do that rather than like, well, if they're going to give us these things, we'll go over here. Of course, to a degree, but not, what are you doing? You determine to dictate the rules of the game. I think to me that's an important component, and I think your point of what Turner says is that is good, and unfortunately reminds me of this Georgetown exchange that I would have often.
I think one of the other things that stuck out to me is like the play, like the, there are moments where like people, I think, want to, it's easier to blame one person wholesale, right? Like people are always on Twitter being like, oh, Scott Turner sucks. Like Taylor's, you know, Taylor's fine. It's all in the play calling. It's like, I think it's people got to get comfortable with a level of gray here. Like I think the flea flicker call last night was actually a great play call. Like, And they dialed it up. They got the look. You know, Taylor overthrew the guy. And so, like, to me, it's that's a combination of things. And later, obviously, there are problems with his play calling. But it's people got to be okay with sharing blame here. It's not all one person. And I think that in the same way that you mentioned, you know, Scott Turner might want to seem like the smartest guy in the room, it feels like sometimes people, when they take out their frustrations, want to just make that guy, you know, want to sound like the smartest person in the room and say, hey, you know, it's actually all this guy, when it's really a combination of things.
Right. And plus, like, look, all these NFL games come down to the last second. I have SportsCenter on in the background here while I'm talking to you with the sound off, and they're just replaying the end of that New England Raiders game. And obviously that's like an all-time craziness, but we saw so many crazy games this weekend. Teams are blowing leads, coming back, all these kinds of things. This is the NFL. Like I talked to Tress way after the game last night about this, and you know, complimentary football, that was such a, you know, big buzzword for these guys, right? And to a degree, you were seeing the signs of it last night. Tress Way is getting multiple punts inside, you know, the 5 or 10 yard line, but the 97 yard drive, the defense couldn't hold it up, allowing a 4th and 9 play to convert in there. The offense wasn't doing enough to sort of keep the momentum going over there. And sometimes it just doesn't work out. It's not just any one component, right? I mean, when he kicks it to the 3, if they get a 3 and out, now the offense is set up with really good field position, and maybe just even one first down gets Joey Sly a field goal attempt or whatever. But this is how it goes. It's almost never just one person. That said, let's talk about one position, quarterback. I mean, you mentioned this a little bit earlier. I just don't think, like, when things were going great with Heinicke, and you know, the Heinicke hive is, you know, screaming here, he's the guy, he's all that. And you're like, okay, well, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. He's the same guy we saw last year. Just things are going their way. And then when things start to turn, Heinicke's not good. He's whatever. He's got to do better. I'm like, this is who he is. Like, there's no upside here. He's hit the ceiling. It's impressive what he's done, but this is what it is. They have to figure out ways for these last 3 games to work around it. But if there is one variable they can do. They could switch the quarterback. And I do think, you know, obviously Carson Wentz is at least now active. He was number two this game. This is at least now a debate. For you, what's the debate right now? Is there even a debate in your head to possibly switch? And if so, what's the reasoning behind it?
I don't know if I have a preference on, like, which quarterback they play. I think that the question here for Ron Rivera is, what are you prioritizing? Because if you want a decently high floor and a very capped ceiling, Heinicke is your guy. If you think to yourself, hey, our defense is going to play well enough, and last game was an aberration, and I think if we score 18 to 21 points, that's going to get us into the playoffs. We're going to win two or three of these last games. I think then that's the guy you roll with. If you say, hey, I am not confident that 18 to 21 points is going to be enough. I'm not confident that Taylor will, you know, minimize or, you know, lessen these critical mistakes that he has, and we got to go to Carson Wentz. Then you're saying we need a higher ceiling like the Jacksonville game, and we'll accept a lower floor like the Philadelphia game or the Dallas game earlier this year. So to me, it's less about like who do I think is going to be a better quarterback. I think that obviously they both have their huge struggles. Taylor's not going to take as many sacks, but Carson's going to be able to throw deep much, much better. So the question to me is just for Ron Rivera, what is your appetite for risk, and what is the best thing for you to do for your team?
Yeah, for sure. And like, you know, the opponent this week kind of clouds the circumstance because they're at San Francisco, as we know, on Christmas Eve, and the 49ers, you know, have one of the best defenses in the league. Their pass rush is pretty, pretty potent. And, you know, Washington's offensive line, that's been the one constant all year. At various points, the defense was giving up big plays. They've closed that down. The receivers weren't getting the ball enough. Now that's happening. The run game wasn't going enough. That's going fine now, or whatever. The offensive line not being so great, particularly in pass protection, has been a constant. And this is the wrong opponent for that kind of an issue. And you're right. I mean, if you go with Heinicke, you're limiting the ceiling, but in theory, you're giving yourself a quarterback with more, well, not in theory, you're giving yourself a quarterback with more mobility. Whether that's enough to matter, you know, in terms of scoring points and you know, Heinicke was the one taking the hits yesterday, far more than Daniel Jones. That's a thing. But yeah, Carson Wentz gives you the bigger ceiling because of his ability to throw the ball down the field, his size, all that. Last week I asked Ron Rivera, half serious, half joking, but mostly serious, about what, like, it's insane to use multiple quarterbacks in the same game. That's like, you know, Harry High School kind of stuff, or the Houston Texans. but like, I don't know, like, part of me kind of like at this point, kind of like, look, rather than pick one of the two, what if you used Heinicke from the 20 to the 20 on some level and Carson Wentz in the red zone? I'm not saying this is realistic. I'm saying if we're going to be at a point where it's pick or choose, who are you going with? What are you doing? Shouldn't this be at least a discussion point? Because on some level, having them both would alleviate, it would allow you to sort of alleviate the concerns that each player provides while maximizing what they can do. Would you buy any of that if Ron Rivera says, yeah, screw it, we're going to go with both of them somehow? I'd like that, I think, but what do you think?
There's that legendary quote where it's like, if you got two quarterbacks, you got none. That to me is sort of where we're at. If you're playing two quarterbacks, I think you lose the confidence of the team because you're telling the team like, hey, we don't really have confidence in either guy to be that dude for the entire game. But I will say that, and this is maybe an indictment of you know, the Turner and Heinicke, Gray, you know, high for portion of blame or whatever. But the thing that stuck out to me that I was looking up last night is if you divide the red zone up into chunks and you look at the lower red zone and the goal line, so that's like the 14-yard line in, Heinicke has completed only 8 of his 22 attempts. That's the lowest mark in the NFL this year by nearly 10% since 2000 out of 752 qualified quarterback seasons. That completion percentage is tied for 727. And like, he's completed 1 of his 11 passes on 3rd and 4th down. And it's just, it's like, Scott Turner in the red zone is very balanced as a play caller. You know, it's almost 50-50 run pass. And that works in the high red zone. You saw it last night with the touchdown to Jahan. Like, there are windows that Taylor can see that he can throw into. It's just like, for whatever reason, that's enough space. When you get in the lower red zone, it's clearly a massive problem. And Turner's insistence or tendency towards balance actually really hurts them. And so to me, if you said, hey, Carson Wentz has that arm, he can fit in the throws, which is ironic considering the end of this Tennessee game earlier this year. But if you said, hey, he's going to be better in the lower red zone where we've had massive struggles, especially throwing the ball, then that's acceptable. But to me, like saying, let's go with both guys would be a real vote of non-confidence for both.
I hear you. But like at this point, do you think anybody thinks they have real confidence in either guy? Like, I think that like if this was week three, no, that would be insane. But like, you know, basically like right now they're more or less in the playoffs, like, or not in the playoffs, but these are playoff kind of games. And in any, you got to do what you got to do to win, right? I feel like they're in that mode. That's why to me, I don't think it's as crazy as it is, even though admittedly it's kind of nuts because that's just not how the NFL does things. But you got to do what you got to do.
Wait, you just said it's not that crazy. Okay, it's kind of nuts.
Well, I mean, you know, look, society is a lot of groupthink and it's hard to be at step outside the box. And do, you know, it's like, you know, one of my favorite movies is Moneyball. And when Bill, you know, it's easy now to say, well, of course this makes sense. But when Billy Bean is starting to do that, he's getting like, you know, mocked, side-eyed. What's going on here? This is terrible. But it made sense. And now everybody does that. That's all I'm saying. Like, I mean, I'm not saying the world's going to all of a sudden start using two quarterbacks. But, you know, if for example, if we said, hey, they're going to use John Bostic in passing situations, but David Mayo in the run. Okay, right? You take advantage of what both guys can do. I'm just saying maybe it's something to consider, even if it's the most important position, and it would look weird and you'd be uncool. It'd be like shooting free throws granny style or something. Like people are going to make fun of you. But if it gives you the best chance, I'm not going to ignore it. That's all I'm saying.
I hope someone aggregates this podcast and like the headline is like standing : two quarterbacks are the new on base percentage.
Hey, you just, you know, you got to do what you got to do. All right, let's go to a couple other things here before I let you go. The 2-point conversion attempt, you know, third quarter, they're down 14-3 at halftime. That was their largest deficit in the game since week 7, but they come out, they score a touchdown. Pretty quick, the really nice pass from Heinicke to Dotson, who Dotson had a really good game yesterday. And then they decided to go for two. There's like 8 minutes or so roughly left in the third quarter. I don't know what the number said. I didn't like that call. And I'm not somebody who like poo-poos the analytics and says, you know, you can't go with that stuff. But when you're a team that is struggling to put up points, period, in a game where the other team is going to be as well, I think you just take the actual point whenever you can get it. And obviously I know they threw a 2-point play. It worked, but there was the refs ruled that, Jahan Dotson was committed a OPI on the play, the rub play, pick play, whatever you want to say. Okay. Bad luck there that they got called, but I didn't like going for two that early in a game in which points are limited, and you have to think your defense is going to be able to slow the Giants down enough. This isn't a game where you're like, oh, we can't stop the other team, we gotta, you know, do whatever. So I didn't personally like that. I'm not saying they lost the game because of that, but instead of being, you know, I just don't like taking the points. And I think to a degree that extra point kind of screwed them a little bit. You know, the final margin was 8, you know, they still would have had got a 2 at the end even if they had gotten the touchdown.
So I think there's a couple of things to address here. First, this was not, in my sense, a case of the analytics suggest being aggressive, like in the fourth quarter when you score to go down 15 or down 8. This is not one of those things where people can like curse the spreadsheets and say like, why do you follow that? This to me was more of Ron Rivera sensing that, you know, he wanted to give his team a spark. He wanted to maximize the points, which I think is again, really important, because when you have a run first offense that relies on sustaining long drives, which is very hard to do in the NFL, like you got to maximize your point totals when you're down there. And I think that when you've given up a sack fumble and you're already, you know, giving them 7 points, to me, I wonder if Ron Rivera was almost saying, okay, we gave them 7. Now we got to be a little bit more aggressive and get that back. I get that it doesn't work out, so it looks bad in retrospect. But to me, I like the aggressiveness just because this offense has struggled to score points, and you got to maximize every trip.
Yeah, and I will say, like, I don't like the game of saying I didn't like the play call because it didn't work, or that was a great play call because it did work. So I'm with that. I like I said, for me, it just felt like a bit much. But we don't have to labor on that. Good thoughts on there. Here's another question. We talked before about the Brian Robinson situation, that he only had 12 carries, and it seemed like they got away from one. Well, it doesn't seem like they got away from him when that was really working. But what's interesting is he only had 24 snaps in the game total. Gibson was about 36, 38 snaps total. And that's really interesting because that's not the first time in a while where Gibson had substantially more than Robinson. And I'm wondering, since I don't know about any kind of an injury, I'm wondering if this was a case of they felt they needed to pass to try to kind of keep going, you know, to come back a little bit. And they just feel that Gibson they're more comfortable with Gibson both as a pass catcher, but maybe also a pass blocker. And that led to them not using Robinson as much. What's your view on that, or just why Robinson only got 24 snaps, let alone 12 carries?
Yeah, I saw that as a byproduct of just the game flow and the situation. Like with J.D. McKissic hurt, you know, I think the AG, especially, you know, as you've seen in previous games, is more explosive out of the backfield. I think he's a more natural receiver. That's his game. And so, you know, when you're down by a couple scores, or when you're down by eight, you know, and you're trying to come back and you're passing, like, he's the guy you're going to want on the field. So we haven't seen them trail in that way in a little bit. Obviously, they did to some degree at the end of that Giants game, the last Giants game. But I didn't see it as anything other than game flow and Scott Turner deciding, hey, we need to throw the ball a little bit more here.
For sure. All right. Lastly, I guess, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's just, you know, we were both in the locker room last night. And for me, like the lead of my story was more or less like how a lot of these guys just looked like zombies afterwards. And it's not like they haven't lost games before, but this was different. This was different because, like, they were the favorite team. Even if they were playing the team that they just tied, you know, the point spread suggested people were viewing them as better than the Giants. I think a lot of people think that they are, at least in terms of, like, general talent. I think the coaching may be a little bit different. I think the Giants have done really well there. But you had the crowd was, you know, was as much pro-Washington as they've had at home, you know, probably this season. National TV, this was a chance to really show, hey, we are a team you have to pay attention to in the NFC. And then they just came out so flat. Let me rephrase that. I don't know if they came out flat. They just lost the game. I mean, you know, they were the team that scored first. I don't know if they came out flat, but whatever. Now what? You know, now, you know, like, they're going to play, you know, arguably the best team in the NFC right now in San Francisco. Or I guess, you know, it's hard to argue it's not Philly. You know, you lose this game, you know, you pretty much have to win your last two. I'm not saying they are about to just throw in the towel by any stretch, but, you know, you do wonder a little bit, like, where their mentality is. I think those three runs in a row by Saquon Barkley after the Heineke, his second fumble, looked to me almost like a team that was, like, kind of losing it there for a minute. What do you think happens now? Like, what's your best guess in terms of where this team is at mentally, you know, everything else? You know, was this the high mark of the year because, you know, going into the game because they were so jacked up and now they've hit a real low, or are they just going to turn around because this is the NFL and week to week things are, you know, things don't even matter that much?
This is a really interesting test, right? Because of all the schedule circumstances that you mentioned, it's not dissimilar. I hesitate to draw like a one-to-one comparison because last year they were going through COVID, but the wheels came off in Dallas, you know, that basically ended their season. John Allen, Daron Payne, you know, getting in the fight on the sideline, like around, you know, it was Christmas weekend last year where things just totally imploded. And this year, for a lot of reasons, it feels different. Yesterday was a massive, massive loss for them because, like you said, they failed to capitalize on a good home crowd. And, you know, it's a big game in year three for them to take a step forward to hopefully make the playoffs. But how do they respond in San Francisco? I think that's going to be a real litmus test. I don't think that the wheels are going to fall off. I don't sense that there's the undercurrent of tension or frustration that there was when COVID was going on, because there was so much out of their control. But I mean, if they go and get absolutely blown out on Saturday night, that's going to be a big problem, and really would make me question, is this team able to be competitive in their last two games, particularly against, you know, Dallas at the end of the year. So all of that to say, I think that they're going to come out and be competitive. I don't think that they're going to win. I think that they could lose by 10 points or, you know, somewhere around there. But as long as they don't get blown out, I think that they have a chance to get into the dance at the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't even really discuss the playoff thing. I mean, obviously, their road now is a lot more complicated, but it's hardly impossible. They're still the seventh seed as today with 3 weeks to go. Seattle and Detroit are right behind them, and obviously Detroit is, like, one of the hottest teams in the league. But, you know, if they win two of their last three, they're probably in. Simple, you know, sort of basic simple math. They probably won't catch the Giants at this point, unless the Giants just completely go 0-for down the stretch. But yeah, I mean, this is a weird setup. The opponent's really good. You're on the road, short week, coming off a really disappointing loss. They clearly were emotional about it. You know, one player to me almost looked like he was kind of welling up almost a little bit. You know, it's tough. So we'll see how they can come out of this. I think they've been pretty good. That locker room, as we know, they're pretty tied together. They you know, that hasn't been an issue. We'll see how they battle through this. And I do think the quarterback situation is something that could be a factor. By the way, do you think Carson Wentz plays next week? I'll ask you that, and I'll let you get out of here.
I feel like that, to me, is not quite at the level of uncertainty of, is Chase Young going to play next week? But it's really difficult to say. I would say that we see him before the end of the year, but next week, I'm not exactly sure.
He is at Sam, the number 4TR on Twitter. Read him at the Washington Post. Good stuff today on the red zone woes. And look, when you're trying to get out of a stadium and you're trying to scale a barrier to get back into real life, you know, he's a good wingman to have for sure. Even though I injured my forearm somehow in the moment, what a ridiculous time that was. Sam, I appreciate it, my guy. Have a good one. Get some rest, and we'll talk later.
Standing, you do as well. I always appreciate coming on. Thanks for having me, and I'll see you in the burn tomorrow.
Absolutely. Thanks, man. All right. I really enjoyed that conversation with Sam. Before that started, I had mentioned on Twitter that I was going to record a pod. And if anybody had questions or comments or whatever, to fire them away at me on Twitter at Ben Standing. So some of you did. And I wanted to answer some of these things as best I could. One question here from @big_John_1906. Will this season's outcome be enough to finally land the plane on being aggressively mediocre and go out and get a real quarterback and OC? So a couple things here. I do think they have aggressively tried to go find a quarterback. I mean, I think Ron Rivera, you know, they tried to get Matthew Stafford. That, you know, it was, you know, sort of a deal there for the Rams that the Commanders just couldn't top. And this past offseason, you know, they went and tried to go from the top of the league to the bottom to try to find somebody. And they landed on Wentz, who, you know, he's in that category of guys you probably don't want to start, but you can if you have to. And Heineke's probably in there as well, but, like, you know, more towards the back end of that group. And it's not like there really were too many other options. Again, we've talked about before, you know, maybe you spend the first round pick on Kenny Pickett, but other than that, I don't really know what else they would have done, especially, you know, if you Monday morning quarterback it and look at what other teams have done. There's just not, or what other quarterbacks have done in new spots this year. There just really wasn't anything that impressive. That said, I mean, they've got to come up with a better plan. And even if this is to draft a rookie, I'm not dismissing Sam Howell. I'm just saying he was a fifth round pick. If you're in the first round, wherever they are, and there's a quarterback there, I mean, I think you've got to really take a long look at it, because even if you end up going with a veteran, whether it's some sort of like a Heinicke guy or, you know, somehow Wentz takes some a pay cut, perhaps, whatever it may be, you still need to have a plan for the future. And they just don't have one right now. Plus, to me, this ties into the identity of it all. What quarterback fits what you want to do? Even if it's not a star, what is it that you are trying to accomplish here? And go find a person who can do that. Wentz and Heinicke are incredibly different quarterbacks and athletes. You know, there's no carryover. That's why everything looks so dramatically different when you go from one to the other. So, look, I do think the quarterback issue is a huge concern. It remains so. The one easy way, let me rephrase that. There's no easy way. But one potential way to fix this is if Wentz plays down the stretch here and shows enough, whatever that may mean for them, to say we can keep this guy. Maybe, again, they have to renegotiate a contract, but we can keep this guy, move forward with him, and feel we've got a real shot. Again, Wentz has a great arm. He's got the size. There are questions, but if you build up the offensive line, maybe that's enough. In any event, I think they're always on the look for quarterback. I think they have tried aggressively, but there's only so many of these guys that go around, and they just have not been able to officially get one. @A_process asks, why no Cosme? The most athletic offensive lineman should have been able to contribute a tackle or guard, even if only to keep Lucas and Turner fresher, much less being able to pull on running plays and screens. We did not ask Rivera about that today, about why Sam Cosme received zero offensive snaps yesterday. And now he obviously had been playing at either splitting time at right tackle with Cornelius Lucas or starting at right guard when Trey Turner was out, but then Cosme suffered his own ankle injury and didn't play today. Now, he was active, and he was with the starters at times this week in practice. This, again, the open part that we could see. So, I mean, on the one hand, it's a little surprising they didn't go back to some sort of split. On the other hand, it's kind of abnormal to do a split like that on the offensive line. So, you know, at the end of the day, I do think that Cosme playing guard, we've talked about this a bunch, is maybe ultimately where he ends up. I do think this was one problem for this game, though, was the Giants' defensive line is really good. In fact, if you wanted to make a case that they had the better of the two starting defensive lines, four across, than Washington, I think it's a reasonable argument, in part because they have two excellent tackles in Dexter Lawrence and Leonard Williams, but then they also have two high draft picks on the edges. We saw what Kayvon Thibodeau did. Ojulari is really good as well. So I don't know if that's a group where you want to, if that's where you want to say, let's put Sam Cosme, give him his second career start, or even get significant snaps at guard when he hasn't had the experience. He's coming off the injury. I understand that logic to an extent, but I was a little surprised, and we'll see going forward here what they do. I think Cosme guard is an experiment worth trying, but maybe it's a little just too challenging to do it this late in the year when the wins are above and beyond, or wins are more important right now than developing, right? Let's just say that. @CLT_NY asked, Washington rushed it fewer than 30 times for the first time since week 8. Was it about Wink Martindale's defense that makes Rivera and Turner move away from that proven success metric to throw it more? It's a good question. Sam and I talked about this a little bit. And again, to me, this is about the identity aspect of this. You can say that we're a power running team and all that, but Brian Robinson was running well and doing a really effective job at that with, you know, I mean, and also he isn't just getting yards. He's setting a tone. Don't mess with me is his tone. And yet Washington only ran him four times in the second half, and it's not like they were running anybody else much. I don't necessarily know from the if it had to do with the Giants' defense. I do think the pass rush situation did. New York had double the QB hits, 8-4 on Washington. They had some sacks and tackles for loss, including, of course, the big strip sack by Thibodeau leading to their first touchdown as he picks it up and scores on the touchdown. But Washington was having really good success. Brian Robinson averaged over 7 yards a carry, but only carried it 12 times. I just think, again, I don't want to keep repeating myself here, but I just think that, like, it's not enough to say we want to do these different things. You've got to be able to identify, this is how, what we want to do. We want to dictate terms in this way and go from there. But, you know, it's easier said than done when you don't have an obvious quarterback and they have these playmakers. I just think, you know what, even if it means keeping one of your three receivers off the field, going double, you know, 12 personnel, two tight ends, helping you with the blocking, how, you know, to maximize the running back. I just feel like that would be a pretty good way to go. Let's see here. What other questions do we have? At Scott Mora just simply asks, why, Ben? Why? Scott, if, I don't know how long you've been a fan of this team, but if you've been a fan for a minute, you know heartbreak is part of the deal. At least it has been for the last 20 years. And that was a tough one for sure. Last one here. At Never To Tweet asks, how can you run an NFL caliber offense with a 5'9" quarterback? You know what? 5'9". Let me skip that one. We've talked about Heineke a bunch. Let me see if there's anything else in here of note. Well, I will just say this. I haven't had a chance to watch the All-22 yet. I'm going to be curious to see how they were using the defensive linemen, because it looked to me from the press box that there were times when I'm seeing Deron Payne line up like outside, almost not purely on the edge, but more in that, you know, guard tackle spot or towards towards the tackle, which was unusual, of course, because, you know, he's known, you know, for being, you know, if not over the center, at least next to, lined up next to the center. And in I don't know if he was doing that on these plays, but when Saquon Barkley has three carries in a row for, you know, 12, 15, and 14 yards right after that Heineke second fumble, and it really seemed like that was sort of a, you know, knock the wind out of you kind of moment. I am just sort of curious how much was that about them wanting to worry about Daniel Jones, try to hem him in a bit, and versus not worrying as much about Barkley, who was pretty quiet until that stretch right there, got probably about half of his yards in the game during that time, but they were big yards and that all led to a field goal. So anyway, I will be curious to look at the tape and see how much, or how much they were using Payne and therefore perhaps John Allen wider than normal. I think that'll be something that's to keep an eye on as we get into the film. All right. And just a quick deal here for the schedule this week on the short week. Tomorrow, Tuesday, they're going to have a walkthrough. We will be out there for that. Wednesday and Thursday will be the normal practices, but normal meaning a Thursday and a Friday. And then they head out to California and play Saturday against the Niners. Huge game again, obviously. But this was the Giants game is the bigger game. They need to beat the Niners, but it's not as desperate because there's no tiebreaker in there. But if you lose, you got to probably have to win your last two to make the playoffs. So a lot going on here for the Commanders. We will see what happens. More podcasts to come this week. You know, happy holidays, of course, to everyone. But more podcasts to come here on the Standard Room Only podcast. Until next time, see ya.